We're looking at English translations of the Bible. I want to skip over the first section because while Alfred the Great caused the Bible to be translated into Anglo-Saxon, and while John Wycliffe, in a much more significant translation, in fact it was completed by his followers, and it's more accurately called the Lollard Bible, while they were welcome forerunners, it was only when printing came and when the Reformation came that the great explosion of Bible translations and the real impact of the Bible took place. That's not to undervalue Wycliffe. Perhaps the best measure of the success of Wycliffe and his ministry and his translation was this Synod of Oxford in 1408, summoned by the Archbishop of Canterbury, which forbade anyone to translate or even to read a vernacular version of the Bible, in whole or in part, without the approval of his bishop or of a church council. That's a good measure. If a book's banned, then it's probably doing quite well, like Spycatcher. But John Wycliffe's Bible had the honour of being banned, and it certainly reached as far as Scotland. There's records of people in Ayrshire with a copy of Wycliffe's Bible. But our story really begins with William Tyndale in the 16th century. There's the famous story of Tyndale, the young Protestant, eager scholar, reformer, in debate with a learned Catholic. In communing and disputing with him, Tyndale drove him to that issue that the learned man said, "We were better to be without God's law than to be without the Pope's." Master Tyndale, hearing that, answered him, "I defy the Pope and all his laws," and said, "If God spare my life, ere many years I will cause a boy that drives the plough shall know more of the Scripture than you do." Tyndale had to go to the continent to escape the authorities in England, who still forbade the translation of the Bible. And he spent some time in Wittenberg with Luther. He was also in Antwerp and in some North German cities. And in 1525, 1526, the first version of his New Testament translation came out. It was a translation from the Greek, Erasmus, and the other Greek editions that were available. The Complutensian Polyglot was another famous one. It was a translation that had no verse divisions. One little interesting point. The chapter divisions of the New Testament were only worked out in the 13th century by a cardinal of all people, Hugh de Sancerre. But the verse divisions were only done later in the 16th century. Tyndale added notes. Most of them were purely explanatory, but some were rather controversial. For instance, on Matthew 16, "Thou art Peter, and on this rock I will build my church." Tyndale had a note which expressed in no uncertain terms some doubt about the authority of the Pope. Well, his version wasn't well received by many. Thomas More, who's often idolized these days as the typical liberal scholar and, you know, what a humble, gracious man, his reaction was violent. "Tyndale's New Testament is not the New Testament at all. It was a cunning counterfeit, so perverted in the interests of heresy that it was not worthy to be called Christ's Testament, but either Tyndale's own Testament or the Testament of his master Antichrist." More said, "To search for errors in it was like searching for water in the sea." But when the steam evaporates a little, we find that More's main objection was that Tyndale didn't use the common ecclesiastical terms. He didn't use the word church, for instance. He used the word congregation, to the congregation at Ephesus and so on. He used not the word priest, but the word senior or elder to translate presbyteros in the New Testament. More didn't like that. What More objected to, probably most of all, were these notes, which were clearly, firmly Protestant, sometimes very strongly Protestant in their explanations of what the Bible was saying. Tyndale began work on the Old Testament, translating from Hebrew, publishing the Pentateuch, the five books of Moses, and some extracts from the prophets. But in 1536, he was burnt at the stake in Antwerp, having been betrayed by English agents. And he died crying, "Lord, open the King of England's eyes." Now, you may never have held Tyndale's New Testament or his version of the Bible or the parts of the Old Testament in your hands, but it's almost impossible to overestimate the importance of William Tyndale in our story. The Authorized Version is 90% Tyndale. The Revised Version is some 75% Tyndale. Most, as we shall see, on the back of your green sheet, and glimpse it already, most of the translations of the Bible, right down through to the NASV, the RSV, the Revised Authorized Version, they are revisions of Tyndale. They are based on Tyndale, and they are working on Tyndale. Only the most recent translations, the NEB, the Good News Bible, and the New International Version, are independent of Tyndale. He's had an enormous influence on the Bibles. He's also had an enormous influence on the very language that we speak. Tyndale coined lots of words to translate biblical terms. Perhaps the most famous is the word loving-kindness, which he coined to translate the word chesed in Hebrew, which is the word that describes God's attitude to his covenant people. And it's a blend of faithfulness, of commitment, and of love, mercy, and so on. God's perseverance with his people. Tyndale coined that lovely word, loving-kindness. I've seen it said by no less authority than Trench in his book on the English language that it is to Tyndale that we owe the word beautiful. Tyndale coined the word, and many other words that came into everyday English. Not only words, but spellings. Not only spellings, but syntax, the way that we put sentences together, owes a great deal to Tyndale's translation, which was a translation heavily influenced by the Greek and Hebrew word order. Tyndale, then, the sort of fountainhead of English translations of the Bible. After Tyndale's death, there were several other Bibles. Miles Coverdale completed the Old Testament, but mainly by translating from the Latin Vulgate rather than from Hebrew texts. There was another Bible called Matthew's Bible. Matthew was a pseudonym for a man called Rogers. This too was heavily dependent on Tyndale. But then in 1539, the king himself ordered, Henry VIII ordered, that a translation be made, or that a Bible be placed in every church in England. And when you realise how vehemently Tyndale had been attacked and harried and chased to his death just 3 years earlier, it's remarkable to read a royal injunction that tells the priest to put up a Bible where his parishioners may read it. "You shall discourage no man privily or apertly, openly, from reading and hearing the said Bible, but shall expressly provoke, stir, and exhort every person to read the same, as that which is the very lively word of God, that every Christian person is bound to embrace, believe, and follow, if he look to be saved." Henry's policy may have changed. We rather doubt that his spiritual eyes had been opened. But certainly in God's providence, that great Bible was placed in every church in the land, which even in the days of Mary Tudor, Bloody Mary, were not removed, even though she burnt so many Protestants at the stake. The great Bibles were not all removed from the churches. The next important step in our story comes from that period, though, of persecution, when so many English reformers fled to the continent and gathered, especially in Geneva, that most perfect school of Christ that John Knox described. Geneva was the centre of Protestant studies at that time. It was the university and theological seminary of the Reformed movement. In Calvin himself, in Theodore de Beza, they had two of the leading scholars of Europe. Beza especially had spent a lifetime collecting manuscripts of the Bible, Greek and Hebrew, and comparing them and translating them. Calvin had been very influential in in Olivetin's translation of the Bible into French. And it was no surprise when William Whittingham, and others of the English refugees gave themselves to revising Tyndale's translation. The result, finally completed in 1560, was the Geneva Bible, sometimes often called the Breeches Bible, because in Genesis 3 it says that they took fig leaves and made breeches of them, not aprons as in the AV. It was a great improvement on Tyndale in the Old Testament, or not such on Tyndale, of course, but on the other earlier versions, because it went back to the Hebrew text of the Old Testament that Tyndale hadn't translated. And it did a thorough revision of the Great Bible. It was a very good translation, very readable. For the first time, the verse numbers appeared. There were also marginal notes which indicated variations in the Greek manuscripts, where the translators had manuscripts which said different things. They put a note in the margin stating that this was the case. It was very popular in England and was very formative in the growing Puritan movement because, like Tyndale's version, it had notes, little explanations of the meaning of passages. They were milder than Tyndale's, but they were thoroughly Calvinistic. They had a great influence in spreading Puritanism. And therefore they were unpopular with the bishops and with King James, then King James VI in Scotland. Interestingly, the Geneva Bible was the first Bible ever printed in Scotland, 1579. So that's an added reason for it. The popularity of the Geneva Bible, with its good Calvinistic notes, gave rise to the next Bible, the Bishop's Bible, which, as its name suggests, was a version prepared by the bishops to match the Geneva Bible, to be an alternative to it with more bishop-pleasing notes. Though it was quite a good translation, it didn't match up to the other. It, too, was a revision of Tyndale's version. There was also the Douai Bible, begun about this time, produced by Roman Catholic exiles from England in France. It was heavily influenced by Latin. It did use Tyndale's version to some extent, and it did use Greek manuscripts, but the English that it used was very Latinized. In the parable of the Good Samaritan, where the Good Samaritan gives the innkeeper two pence, and says, if you spend any more, I'll give it to you when I come. Whatsoever thou shalt supererogate, I at my return will repay thee. Words like supererogate abound in the Douai Bible. But that's really a sort of going off at a tangent from our story, because the Douai Bible had no great influence in England. Well, we've just quickly skated over those 16th century Bibles. Notice how many of them there are. Tyndale, Coverdale, Matthew's Bible, the Great Bible, the second edition of it, sometimes called Cranmer's Bible, the Geneva Bible, the Bishop's Bible. Fascinating that there should be so many. Archbishop Parker, the Archbishop of Canterbury, wrote, "Yet should it nothing hinder but rather do much good to have diversity of translations and readings. He felt it was a good thing that there were several translations of the Bible. That's an interesting sort of discussion point. Sometimes we get frustrated because, at a Bible study, everybody's got a different version. But there were certainly those who said, well, look, it's good to have many different versions. For one thing, it makes you stop and check and compare the version that is before you. It makes you question whether this is the best translation. But whether that's an abiding principle or a temporary phenomenon is an interesting question. But we mustn't stop there, because that would really be to break the thread which leads straight on to what I want to call the King James Version, partly because the Great Bible was in a sense the first authorized version, and also because authorized version is a misnomer in many ways. Certainly for us in the Scottish tradition it is. The King James Version came out of the Hampton Court Conference of 1604, which was undoubtedly one of the most disastrous events in the whole of English church history. The Hampton Court Conference was called the year after James VI of Scotland had become James I of England. He'd been promoted in the world, of course. And many people in England had high hopes of this Scottish king. Under the authoritarian reign of Queen Elizabeth I, there had been great repression in England of the Puritan movement. But for Elizabeth's repressive policy and her overruling of Parliament, the Church of England would have become Presbyterian, or Puritan, the words are really synonymous in that time, would have become Presbyterian in the 1570s and the 1580s. There was a majority in Parliament for changing the nature of bishops, the power of bishops, changing the prayer book. But Elizabeth overruled Parliament and dismissed Parliament. She wouldn't have it change her church. The Puritans had been persecuted. An Archbishop of Canterbury had been imprisoned, Archbishop Grindal, because he refused to persecute the Puritans. He was very sympathetic to them. So you see, when James of Scotland, a Presbyterian country, a king committed to uphold the Presbyterian Church of Scotland, when he was made king in England, you can imagine that many of the English Puritans were highly excited. They thought at last the royal oppression, the royal iron grip would be taken off, and the church would become Presbyterian. But James had other ideas. James had had more than enough of Presbyterians in Scotland. And James, when this conference met at Hampton Court of leading bishops and Puritans, the Puritans hoping that the Church of England would be resettled in a Puritan direction, James made it very clear, no bishop, no king. And his extremely high view of the divine right of kings made him, rather than turn the Church of England into a Presbyterian Puritan direction, he turned it into a much more, what we might call, an Anglican direction of royal supremacy, rigorously enforced. And that's why I believe that the Hampton Court Conference was a most disastrous watershed in English church history. But strangely, out of that watershed came the great King James Version of the Bible. James seized eagerly on the suggestion of a new revision of the Bible, authorized to be the only Bible for reading in church services. James, who liked the reputation of a scholar, but was aptly summed up by the saying that he was the wisest fool in Christendom. He stigmatized the Geneva Bible as the worst translation. But what he really objected to were its notes. Now, again, we talk about these notes that these people objected to. So he said it was a terrible thing, this Geneva Bible going around teaching things that were untrue, seditious, dangerous, traitorous conceits. And when somebody at the Hampton Court Conference, I think in fact it was one of the Puritans, suggested that, well, with people arguing between the Geneva Bible and the Bishop's Bible, well, why don't we have another translation of the Bible? James seized on that. But the sort of notes that he objected to, one that he particularly was wrathful about, was one in Exodus that said that the Hebrew midwives were right to disobey Pharaoh's orders to kill the male children of Israel. The note said they were right to disobey that order. James said that was seditious, traitorous. So he didn't want anything that would make people feel that there might be circumstances in which it was right to disobey a king. Well, from those strange origins, there came the great King James Version of 1611. Six panels of translators, 47 in all, met to draft various parts of the scripture, and their products were reviewed by a smaller panel. It was eventually published in 1611. Bible that had no notes, but it did have chapter headings, some of which are almost notes, sort of brief descriptions of what the chapter contains. It reverted to the ecclesiastical terms. It talked about bishops instead of overseers. It talked about church instead of congregation. It also reverted to the common English proper names. The Geneva Bible had transliterated the Hebrew, and it spelt Isaac, I-S-A-H-A-C. But the AV reverted to Isaac in the way that we normally spell it. It did have one unfortunate habit of translating the same name by different words in the Old and New Testaments. Thus you have in Hebrews, if Jesus had given them rest, when Jesus, it means Joshua, of course, and the fact that the way that Elijah is translated Elias, and Isaiah is translated, isn't it, in a different way in the New Testament. That's a strange confusion. But the version was authorized, probably by an order in council for the Church of England, the only version to be used in churches in England. And it's to that authorization that it owes its common title in this country as the Authorized Version. In America, of course, it's known as the King James Version because the authorization is something irrelevant there. It's dedicated to the most high and mighty prince, James. Listen to the first sentence of the dedications in the front of the Bible still. To the most high and mighty Prince James, by the grace of God, King of Great Britain, France and Ireland, defender of the faith. Great and manifold were the blessings, most dread sovereign, which Almighty God, the Father of all mercies, bestowed upon us, the people of England, when first he sent your Majesty's royal person to rule and reign over us. James liked that sort of talk. It made a change from these Presbyterians in Scotland. Andrew Melville had stood in front of the king one day and said, there are twa kings and twa kingdoms in this country. And in the kingdom of Jesus Christ, you are not a king, but God's silly vassal. Rather a change to be called a most dread sovereign, the epitome of God's mercy to England. Well, that's an echo of the origins of the Bible. It reminds us that every Bible, every translation, however good, comes out of mixed and down-to-earth circumstances. The Authorized Version originally was published with a lengthy epistle to the reader, no longer printed in our Bibles, but still available, I think. Steve, is it still in print somewhere? I think somebody did reprint it recently, but it's, if you ever see it, it's worth reading. It's a long thing, but it has three very significant things to say. One is that these translators, wrote the epistle, acknowledge the limitations of their ability, especially in regard to translating Hebrew words. There are places in the Old Testament, especially in Job and Proverbs, where lots of words occur once and once only. Some of those very poetic portions in Job describing Leviathan and snortings and sneezings and so on. And some of the descriptions of down-to-earth life in Proverbs, Hebrew words are used which don't occur anywhere else in the Bible. Words like that are very difficult to translate. How do you decide what a word means? Well, you find as many places as you can where it occurs, and you know, with words that you do know, and you see what it can mean in the context. And by comparing all these places, you can get a sharper and sharper idea of how to translate that word. But there were places, many places there in Job especially, where the translators admitted they really had to guess at it. They get as close as they can and then say, well, we think it means this, but we haven't got any way of checking against another occurrence. The second thing that they mention in their epistle is that the way that they dealt with the different readings that they found in the Greek manuscripts. The versions of the Greek Bible, or the Greek New Testament, and the Hebrew Old Testament that they had, were not all identical. They had differences in them. The way the AV translators dealt with it was that in the margin, like the translators of the Geneva Bible, in the margin they put a note where they found Greek manuscripts with different words. They would translate the one that they thought was the most obvious one, but in the margin they would tell you what the other reading was and what the translation would be if that were the right reading. And they said in their epistle, they that are wise had rather have their judgment at liberty in differences of reading than to be captivated to one when it might be the other. Now, let's translate that into English. Those that are wise would rather be at liberty to make their own judgment between such differences of reading than to be captivated and to have somebody else decide for them when they might be wrong. That's an interesting attitude that they had, and one that obviously we'll pick up when we come to look in future weeks at the question of the how you deal with the different readings that there are in the Greek manuscripts. The other thing that they admit to, much less happily, is that they have used different English words to translate the same word in the original. They defend this by the way that the translation reads, but really I think it is a weakness of the King James Version. One marked instance of it is in Romans chapter 5, verses 2, 3, and 11. In Romans 5, let me just read the phrases out from the AV. This grace wherein we stand and rejoice in hope of the glory of God. Not only so, but we glory in tribulations also. In verse 11, not only so, but we also joy in God. So they've said, we rejoice, we glory, we joy. But Paul used the same word there each time. We boast or we glory. The AV translators decided to translate that by different words. Now, it doesn't matter, I suppose, that much in Romans 5, although it does lose the sort of powerful repetition of these three things that Paul gloried in. But when you come to 1 Corinthians 13 and find a passage which has become a nub of controversy on the cessation of prophecy and so on, then it does matter. We find there in 1 Corinthians chapter 13 and verse 8 that the AV again uses different words for the same Greek word. Charity never faileth, but whether there be prophecies, they shall fail. Whether there be tongues, they shall cease. Whether there be knowledge, it shall vanish away. Now, I haven't got the Greek in front of me, but not all those words, but yes. Whether there be prophecies, they shall be done away. Whether there be knowledge, it shall be done away. It's the same word that's used there. Now, if any of you remember enough that we studied 1 Corinthians 13 a couple of years ago on the charismatic question, it's such a crucial passage on exactly what Paul is saying there, and the fact that he does say something slightly different about tongues. Prophecies shall be done away. Knowledge shall be done away. Tongues shall fade away. But Paul is using words very carefully there, I believe. And it doesn't help. It's unfortunate, let's put it like that, that the clarity, the sharpness of Paul's language was departed from by the translators of the Authorized Version. I'll just make the point now, because we'll probably run out of time later, that one of the improvements of the Revised Version of 1881 was that it reversed this practice of the Authorized Version, and it was their policy to translate the same Greek word by the same English word. And that's why I think on the... where's the green sheet? On the green sheet at the back, where I've put at the bottom, types of translation, literal, free, or paraphrase. That's why I put the Revised Version slightly to the left of the others. It is in that sense, in terms of the literalness of translation, the most accurate, leaving aside questions of differences of the Greek that they were translating. In terms of actual translation, the Revised Version was more literal than the King James, because it insisted on translating every Greek word always by the same English word. The King James Version quickly became a very popular version, partly, of course, because it was the one that was ordered to be used in churches. There were those who didn't like it, though. Strange how versions of the Bible seem to produce violent opposition. A man called Hugh Broughton, who preferred the Geneva Bible, expressed his dislike of the new Bible in these terms: "I had rather been torn in pieces with wild horses than any such translation by my consent should be urged upon poor churches. I require it to be burned." He didn't like it. The Long Parliament, the Puritan-dominated Parliament that eventually led to the Westminster Assembly and the Westminster Confession, considered a new translation. But in the turmoil of the times, nothing was done. Nonetheless, the King James was eventually accepted, even by the Puritans, with their dislike of some of its translations, became the standard Bible of the English people for a considerable period. Because it's so much part of the English language and English history in those periods, there are all sorts of little details that get put in as footnotes in the story of the Bibles. Some were known as He Bibles and some as She Bibles, because early editions seem to vacillate. In Ruth chapter 3 and verse 15, it says there that Boaz filled Ruth's veil with corn and she went into the city. But some Hebrew manuscripts read "and he went into the city." And there were some early editions of the King James Version which put "she went into the city," and others that put "he." She Bibles and He Bibles. there was an edition printed in London in 1631 that left out the word not in the seventh commandment and became quickly known as the Wicked Bible. The printer was fined £300 by Archbishop Laud. One interesting little detail, a misprint crept in very early on into the AV and remains to this day. Our AV says strain at a gnat, but in fact, and swallow a camel, doesn't it? Strain at a gnat. In fact, what it was meant to say, that it was a misprint for strain out a gnat. You strain out a gnat and you swallow a camel. The Authorized Version had great influence on the whole English language that was spoken and written. There's something about its style. Sometimes it's called prose rhymes, the ring of the language. Of course, when we say that, don't let's forget, it's 90% Tyndale. Maybe we should be speaking of Tyndale as having such an influence with his wonderful prose. But as finally revised by the men of 1611, the AV moulded the English language. You listen to politicians and listen to all sorts of secular speeches and you'll hear AV phrases, AV sayings coming out. So many, many biblical terms, expressions have become English idioms, English proverbs in King James Version language. That reflects the fact that that Bible became the language of the English people at a time when the English language was being firmed up, when spelling was being regularized, when the very diverse local dialects were coming together in a sort of general English. And, of course, it was the Bible at a time when church-going was very widespread in England. So the Bible that was used, for many people, it was the only book they had or heard. They didn't have a radio to listen to. They didn't have BBC English. All they had were the scriptures read in the church. And the Authorized Version, the King James Version, to a large extent moulded the English language. Now, it's a fascinating thought to think about in the bath or wherever you think. Can that happen today with English? You can conceive, I think, that it could happen in countries where our Wycliffe Bible translator friends are working. The language of a tribe, never been written down before. Along comes a Bible translator, does his linguistic studies, develops an alphabet, writes down, translates the Bible into that language. It's then printed, and the people have the first book they're taught to read for the first time. Now, you can well imagine, I think, that that book is going to have a tremendous influence back on the language. Is going to mould the language, give it lots of expressions. That's to some extent what the King James Version did to English. But English today is a worldwide language. Our language today is not open to be influenced by one book, unless I suppose there were some tremendous revival throughout the English-speaking world. I think that's one of the problems we face in considering new translations of the Bible, leaving aside all other questions. Because the AV did so much to mould the English language from the 17th century through to the 19th century, the 20th century, it's impossible that any other version would have a similar impact on the language. I don't think that anybody is going to come up with a version today that is going to mould the English language for the next 300 years. We're in a different world. We're in a different language situation. We're not comparing like with like. But, say, that's a subject for meditation and perhaps especially to consider when we come on to look not at the question of the text, what we translate, but the question of translation. What is a good translation? how do you translate into the vulgar tongue? In the 19th century, a movement gathered strength among the churches that there must be a revision of the Authorized Version. There were three reasons for this. One was that the English language itself had changed. Again, it's an intriguing point. I would suggest to you that the English language began to change with increasing speed in the 19th century because of the Industrial Revolution. Because especially, forgive me for my own hobby interests, but especially because of railways. You know, the railways had a tremendous influence on bringing the country together. Did you know, for instance, here's a hobby horse of mine, but did you know, for instance, that it was the railways that brought time to every part of our country? Until the railways came, every village and town and neighbourhood sort of had its own rough time. But when you start running a train from London to Bristol or London to Glasgow, it helps if the clocks in London say the same thing as the clocks in Glasgow. You know, an hour or so either way isn't much help. And it was the railway companies with their telegraph wires that invented a system of making clocks in London and Glasgow say the same. The country was made smaller, it was made a unit in the 19th century in a way that it had never been before. And the language was changed by the Industrial Revolution, by the great social change of urbanisation, the melting pot, people being drawn in from their country districts into the great cities. The English language began to change then, and now in the 20th century with the communications revolution, with international English, with American influence perverting our language and others purifying it and so on, the language is changing more and more rapidly. 1960s language sounds terribly dated today. Nothing square or dodgy today, is it? But some of us can remember when everything was swinging or dodgy. The language is changing very rapidly. In the 200 years or 300 years after the writing of the King James Version, I don't think the language changed nearly as much. By the second half of the 19th century, though, there was an awareness that so many words had changed their meanings. The word let in Authorized Version English means the opposite of what it means today. If I say, I let you come in, it means I allow you to come in. In the AV, to let means to hinder, to stop. The word prevent has changed its meaning. In Psalm 119, David said, I prevented the dawning of the morning. He didn't mean he stopped the sun rising. He meant he preceded it. He was up early. When Paul says to the Thessalonians, we who are alive will not prevent those who are asleep, he meant we will not come before them. The word prevent has a different meaning today to what it is then. The word conversation then meant conduct, way of life, not speech. The word master, so often used to Jesus, means not employer, boss, but teacher, as in schoolmaster in King James English. The word nephew, used of widows if they have children or nephews, nephews meant grandson, grandchildren. The word charity was used with a different meaning in 1 Corinthians 13 to what the word charity has today. The word salute, Mary saluted, or Elizabeth saluted her cousin Mary. She didn't give a military salute, she greeted her. The English language has changed. Its use of prepositions has changed. When Paul says in 1 Thessalonians 1 verse 4, we know your election of God. If you gave that to somebody today who knew nothing of the Bible and nothing of the AV, their natural paraphrase of that was that these people had chosen God. Your election of your MP means that you have chosen your MP. But then, of course, of meant by, your election by God. English had changed. Particular words and phrases, the use of prepositions, had changed their meaning. And there was recognised that there was a need for a new translation. There was also new knowledge of the meaning of many Hebrew and Greek words. Remember those words in Job and Proverbs we spoke of. Studies in the ancient Middle East, the findings of archaeology, the greater knowledge of the sister languages of Hebrew, meant that scholars were able to find other occurrences of those strange words and to shed more light on their meaning. That's especially noticeable in the book of Job. And here I'm trying to just state facts. We'll evaluate them in the coming weeks. There were, since the King James Version had been translated, many more manuscripts of the Greek New Testament especially, but also of the Hebrew Old Testament, available. Soon after the AV had been published, an important manuscript was given to Charles I, the Codex Alexandrinus, too late to be used by the AV translators, who used the other manuscripts they had. But over the years, from 1600 onwards, all the time, more and more manuscripts were being found. A great many were found in the 19th century, almost entirely, because the Middle East was opened up to archaeology. Up till the time of Napoleon, the Middle East had been a sort of forbidden land to Europeans. Very few Europeans travelled to the Middle East in the 16 and 1700s, but with Napoleon's invasion of Egypt, and remember that he took nearly as many archaeologists as he took soldiers with him, and the French made great finds in Egypt. That was followed, for instance, by Robert Murray McShane and Andrew Bonar going on that pioneering tour of the Holy Land. Their record was written rather like we'd read an account of someone going to the moon today, going to this, this sort of distant land, this fabled land that nobody had been to, and coming back and telling what it looked like. And as these men went and dug there, they found old inscriptions. As they toured the old synagogues of Cairo and the old monasteries of the Coptic Church and the Orthodox Church, they came back with many more manuscripts of the Greek and Hebrew Bible. That process goes on in Egypt, where the sand and the dryness of the sand preserves papyrus and ancient documents peculiarly well. More and more fragments and portions of ancient documents have been found this century. And of course, there's the most famous of all, the finding of the Dead Sea Scrolls with their copy of Isaiah, which was 1,000 years older than any known copy before. That process had gathered great momentum in the 19th century. And men said, look, we need to evaluate these many, many more manuscripts that have been discovered, and we need to revise the translation of the Bible in the light of them. The translators of the Authorized Version and the Geneva Bible would not have disagreed with that. They themselves evaluated all the manuscripts that they could find, and as we've seen, they put notes in the margin as to the different readings. Whether or not they would have come to the same decision about those manuscripts and which readings to adopt, whether they would have changed the text that they translated in just the way that was done in the 19th century is another matter. But that's what we'll have to look at in the coming weeks. But that was a reason why in 1881, or I think it was 1881, a revised version was published. The committee that prepared it had 54 scholars on, including two well-known Free Church of Scotland professors, Patrick Fairbairn and David Brown, men whose books have been republished by the Banner of Truth in recent years. I mention that because sometimes the impression's given that everybody who touched the revised version was a terrible heretic, a follower of higher criticism and so on. Patrick Fairbairn was a great upholder of conservative views of the Old Testament. David Brown was a most accurate conservative scholar in New Testament. And men such as that were involved in the preparation of the revised version. Doesn't mean, of course, that they're infallible, but that's the fact of the case. As I've said, they tried to be more accurate in translation than the AV. The result, though, was rather stifled in English terms. Victorians, I don't think, were capable of writing readable English anyway. But the RV never became very popular, perhaps because it was so close to the AV in much of its translation, but also because it was rather wooden in its language. There was an American edition of it done by or revised by American scholars that was known as the American Standard Version. That was published in 1901. Has some differences with the revised version. And it's interesting that Professor John Murray always used the American Standard Version. He regarded it as the most accurate and dependable of translations of the Bible. And if you read his original writings, all his quotations are from the ASV. In the 20th century, of course, translations have proliferated. There have been private ones by individuals, Moffat, Weymouth, etc. But then there have been a whole series of major translations. The Revised Standard Version, completed in 1952, was, as its name suggests, a revision of the American Standard Version. Used quotation marks for the first time. Attempted to use, in revising the ASV, the findings that had been made since that time. It's the main criticism of the RSV is that in its translation of words, it sometimes blurs important distinctions. For instance, in Romans 3, it uses the word expiation instead of propitiation, which may sound very abstruse to the ordinary person, but if you study carefully the doctrine of the atonement, a great deal turns on the difference. Did God blot out sin, or did God satisfy his wrath by punishing sin in Jesus Christ? It's a very important distinction, and the RSV fails the test there of theological accuracy. Another revision of the ASV was the New American Standard Version of 1971. This was carried out by evangelical scholars. It is a literal translation, trying to retain as far as possible the word-for-word order and translating one Greek or Hebrew word by one English one, using and translating all the conjunctions of the original. The alternative is a free translation which tries to convey the concept of the sentences, the meaning of the sentences of the original. The NASV is a very good version in many ways, free of the suspicion of theological bias that hangs over some parts of the RSV. It is, though, rather stilted in language, and it has some unfortunate things that come probably from American fundamentalism. It insists in many of its versions in using red type for the words of Christ. It uses capital letters in pronouns that refer to the deity. If it thinks the he of a sentence refers to God, then it puts a capital H. You might think there's nothing, no problem with that. But when you come to the prophets, some of the statements of Isaiah about the branch shall do this or the servant shall do this, then the NASV makes a stab at deciding whether that's a prophecy of Christ. If it thinks it is, it puts the pronouns in capital letters. But that gets it into muddy waters, and it's hard to be consistent. Much better to follow the King James Version and leave all the pronouns in small letters. Greek and Hebrew don't have any difference in the way pronouns are written, so why add it to a version of the Bible now? It's also rather clumsy in the way that it retains thou for addressing God, but uses you for addressing the single individual. It doesn't always do that consistently, and when all is said and done, thou is not modern English. But for all those faults, the NASV is a good revision of the ASV and is probably the best version available in that line of translations which has come down through the revised version of 1880. One other that I want to mention there quickly, just before we close, is the revised authorized version. That's the latest translation. In America, it's known as the New King James Version. That seeks to do two out of the three things that the revised version did. It seeks to change the translation of English words that have changed their meaning. It seeks to bring in the greater knowledge of the meaning of Hebrew and Greek words, but it refuses to accept any of the readings of manuscripts that have been discovered since the authorized version was translated. Now that, of course, brings in the subject we're going to deal with, that whole question, whether we should stick for all time to the Greek text that the authorized version was based on, or whether we should accept readings from more recent discoveries of old manuscripts. We're going to look at that in the coming weeks. But if you take the view that you shouldn't accept any new texts, any new Greek readings, that we must translate exactly what the authorized translated, then the RAV is a very good version. If you're here on Saturday, Ashiel Blaise read from it in the rally. And for one thing, it's very easy to follow. If you've got an authorized version, it's very easy to follow when somebody's reading in the revised authorized version. It cuts out the wouldists and couldists and things like that. But it does still follow pretty well the words of the authorized version. If you look on the back of your green sheet, you'll see where we've got to. We haven't time to go in detail into all the others. I just want to say a quick word about the NIV. But see that all the versions we've talked about so far are in this family line. They all come from Tyndale. On the pink sheet, you'll see Psalm 23 in various versions there. Coverdale's version from the prayer book I put on for interest. That was one that was sort of on the edge of the line from Tyndale. But if you compare the King James, if you've got good magnifying glass, you can read the revised version. Sorry, that was the only one I had with me. The RSV and the RAV, and you will see how few differences there are between them. They are all versions of Tyndale's translation. There at the bottom right, you'll see one which is a new translation, in the sense that the translators of the New English Bible did not set out to revise an existing version. They didn't set out to do the latest revision of Tyndale, in other words. They set out to make a completely new translation. And you'll see there the product. The New International Version is an evangelical attempt to do the same thing. People said, well, look, we value the Tyndale tradition, but the English language has changed so much now, and we feel the time has come simply to start again from scratch and to translate the Greek and Hebrew directly into modern English. The NEB tried to do that. It suffered from being done by academics and produced rather ponderous English. It also suffered from being done by many men who were not evangelical believers in the scripture and were far too ready to have a guess at what they thought the text should mean or should say, rather than translating what it did say. The Good News Bible is another completely new translation. Sometimes it is rather paraphrasing in its attempt to write clear modern English. When it speaks about somebody being in the stocks, it says somebody had their feet between heavy blocks of wood. which is a sort of explanation of what stocks are. You can see the point, though. Do people know what stocks are? I don't mean BP shares, but, you know, is stocks a word that is modern English? If it isn't, how are you going to translate the Greek word? That's a sort of problem of translation. The Good News Bible does tend to be paraphrasing. For three transgressions of Damascus and four in Amos becomes the people of Damascus have sinned again and again. The NIV is a better translation than that. It's in the same sort of area, but it is a much more accurate and though still a readable version than the Good News version. It's more dignified than that. The aim has been to express faithfully in modern English what the Bible writers meant. The question there is, does concern that sort of question. Do you translate word for word, or do you convey the meaning in idiomatic English? We'll look at that in question of translation. If you think that new translations are the thing, that we shouldn't try to adapt Tyndale to the 20th century, we should recognize that the English language is different, then the New International Version is far and away the best of the new translations. My own suggestion to you is that you take note of those lines there in terms of translation, leaving aside the textual question that we'd look at in upcoming weeks, and that you say, well, it's a good thing to have a version from each of those. I'd be happy to use the NIV, though in your Bible study I would always suggest that you use the NIV and the King James Version, or and the Revised Authorized Version. Sorry, I haven't put that on the list there. But use one with the other. There's a lot to be said for the old Revised Version, difficult though it might be to find these days, or even more difficult, the American Standard Version, because it is so literal. Then you can check and see whether the NIV is being a bit free or a bit too free in its translation. The time's gone, but I do just want to finish with these two lessons. Notice that line may surprise you. See that the King James Version stands in the middle